Today we come to the account of the death and crucifixion of the Son of God. It's found in Mark chapter 15, 21 to 41. How do you know when you're coming to the close of something, the end of something? Well, sometimes there's a sign. It lets you know. How do you know when you're coming to the end of a movie? Well, if you've fallen asleep and you wake up and the credits are rolling, you know you're getting close to the end. Sometimes we wonder, when are we coming to the close of the sermon? Sometimes if you hear the words, therefore, or finally, or in conclusion, maybe we're getting close to the end of the sermon. How do you know when you're coming to the end of the mission of the Son of God? Well, Jesus had told his disciples that his mission was to come and to give his life away as a ransom for many. And he tried to persuade his disciples that a necessary piece of his mission was suffering. He told them not once, not twice, but three times that it was necessary for him to suffer, that God's way of working out our salvation entailed the suffering of the royal son. And so now we come to a passage where there is great suffering, an extremity of suffering, and that is the clue that we are coming close to the accomplishment of the mission of Jesus. Now, as predicted, the Son suffers. It's Friday, April 3rd, A.D. 33. Mark unfolds this part of the story of Jesus in a couple of segments, and I'm going to read the passage to you beginning at verse 21 of Mark chapter 15. A certain man from Cyrene, Simon, the father of Alexander and Rufus, was passing by on his way in from the country, and they forced him to carry the cross. They brought Jesus to the place called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. Then they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. And they crucified him, dividing up his clothes. They cast lots to see what each would take. It was 9 in the morning when they crucified him. The written notice of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." They crucified 2 rebels with him, one on the right, one on his left. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, "So, you who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, come down from the cross and save yourself." In the same way, the chief priests and the teachers of the law mocked him among themselves. "He saved others," they said, "but he can't save himself. Let this Messiah, this King of Israel, come down now from the cross that he may see and believe, that we may see and believe." Those crucified with him also heaped insults on him. At noon, darkness came over the whole land until 3 in the afternoon. And at 3 in the afternoon, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" When some of those listening near heard this, they said, "Listen, he's calling Elijah." Someone ran, filled a sponge with wine vinegar, and put it on a staff, and offered it to Jesus to drink. "Now, leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to take him down," he said. With a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. The curtain of the temple was torn in 2 from top to bottom, and when the centurion who stood there in front of Jesus saw how he died, he said, "Surely this man was the Son of God." Some women were watching from a distance. Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James the younger and of Joseph, and Salome. In Galilee, these women had followed him and cared for his needs. Many other women who had come up with him to Jerusalem were also there. So I'm understanding this passage in 2 parts. First, we have a crucifixion segment in 21 to 32. Jesus' crucifixion is portrayed in 3 scenes. Scene 1, I'm going to call Helping Jesus. Now, at first, that doesn't seem quite right. Nobody helps Jesus. Jesus doesn't need any help. He's the Son of God. Why would we say helping Jesus? Well, Jesus wasn't doing so well. He had just endured the Roman flogging. Some people died after experiencing a Roman flogging. So Jesus was understandably having difficulty, and he couldn't carry his cross. And so Simon was selected, he was dispatched, he was ordered. I don't think when Simon got out of bed that morning he thought, wow, today I'm going to help the Son of God. No, this wasn't something voluntary. It was pretty involuntarily. It was involuntary. He was told, you will help this man carry his cross. And so he did. And in so doing, I think it's safe to say he helps move Jesus' mission forward. My wife tells me the story of when she lived in Mexico, and one time two women missionaries had a flat tire. She was one of them. Diane, being the eager beaver that she is, starts fixing the flat. She fixes a flat better than most guys. And a police officer showed up, and so he starts fixing her flat. And then another bystander shows up, and the policeman turns to him and says, you fix the flat. And he fixed the flat. Well, when this man, Simon, encountered the execution squad, and they told him to carry Jesus' cross piece, probably wasn't his whole cross, but rather the horizontal beam, you carry it, he carried it. And in so doing, he helped the Son of God. So I would say then that Jesus' suffering, whatever else it might involve, involves others in his mission. We see this also in the book of Acts. When the church hurts, people are often involuntarily drawn into the mission of God. You remember the story of the stoning of Stephen? And after he was killed, there was this upsurge of persecution that swept through Palestine, and Christians were displaced from Jerusalem. And where did they land up? In Judea and Samaria, which is exactly what Jesus had said earlier in the book of Acts. He said that you will be my witnesses, not only in Jerusalem, but beyond. But apparently the church, for whatever reason, wasn't moving beyond. And so God turned up the heat through the pain of persecution. And the church was dispatched in that way. And one of the men who was dispatched was a church leader by the name of Philip. And Philip went to Samaria initially, and he had a ministry of preaching and healing. And then later on, he was dispatched down to the desert road, where he had a divine appointment with an Ethiopian eunuch. You remember that story. And so certainly in the book of Acts, we can see how people, because of suffering, the suffering of persecution, were involuntarily drawn into the mission of God and, in a sense, helped move it forward. And I think that's what was happening here in Mark chapter 15. How has the love of Christ constrained you recently? And when I think of the love of Christ, we have to include the passion of the Christ. We have to think of the events of Good Friday and Easter as well. How has the love of Christ constrained you missionally lately? Sometimes I find myself being drawn into things somewhat involuntarily. Recently, it was brought to my attention that the city of Red Deer was having an event called a social policy framework. And they invited certain stakeholders in the community to be a part of it. I had never heard of this. I didn't know what it was. Sounded like a good idea. I just didn't think it had my name on it. And initially, I had said no. And then I was praying. And it's funny how sometimes when you begin to pray, you get this sense that maybe some of the directions in your life aren't entirely right. And I was thinking about it. It dawned on me, you know, when was the last time that the city came to a church leader and said, look, we're designing and developing some policies that hopefully will be for the good of the citizens. We'd like your point of view. We'd like some feedback from you. And so I got back in touch with him and I said, can I change my no to a yes? And I felt like I was being somewhat involuntarily drawn out of my zone of comfort to kind of get out there a bit more. And I'm glad I did. It was, I thought, a productive gathering. The irony, I think, of all this is that, and think about this with me, although Jesus couldn't bear his cross that day, before the day was done, he had borne the sins of the world. Isn't that amazing? In his weakness, in his powerlessness, what accomplishments he made. The second scene in the crucifixion segment we'll call, crucifying Jesus, verses 22 to 28. And there are six notes in this scene. And Mark just pumps them out. Bum, 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 bum. He just machine guns them out there. He doesn't tell us a lot about them. He just unloads them on his readers. He tells us about the execution site. It was Golgotha. It was named Place of the Skull. I think we have a picture of a skull-like rocky outcropping in Palestine. There were many of these. We're really not sure exactly where Jesus was crucified. We have a couple of good guesses, but apparently it had that kind of a skull-like look to it. I don't know if there were actually human skulls there because of all of the executions that the Romans had carried out there, but it was Golgotha, the place of the skull. It was a real place. Mark also notes that somebody offered Jesus a kind of narcotic, a drug to help deaden the pain. And he said, "No, I will experience my suffering full strength." By the way, I don't do this. I don't experience my pain full strength. Recently had the joy of a root canal, and after it was all said and done, they gave me an envelope with four really big pills, like Advil, like industrial size Advil, 600 milligrams apiece. I could have asked them for a couple of those envelopes, and I wouldn't have felt guilty. But Jesus doesn't take the painkiller. He takes the pain. Mark goes on, and he describes how the clothes of our Lord were gambled. And if you're reading it in a Greek text, a part of the verse is in italics, which means that it's a quote or a citation from an Old Testament passage. Somewhere in Psalm 22, actually verse 18, it talks about how the psalmist rather talks about how his clothes were gambled away. And I think this is Mark's way of reminding us that what happens to Jesus happens by design. This fits into a larger plan that God had for his son, and Jesus embraces it. He tells us the time of his crucifixion. It was 9 a.m. He reviews the charges that were brought against Jesus. He's charged with sedition, being the king of the Jews. I don't think anybody in power actually believed that Jesus thought he was the king of the Jews, but those were simply convenient ways of framing the charge against him. They didn't really understand who he was. And then finally they named the fellow victims. And this reminds me of a passage in Isaiah 53 where it says that the suffering servant would one day be numbered amongst the transgressors. Sounds like something my mother would have said. You know, a person is known by the company they keep. And here Jesus was, you know, on the left and on the right. He was in the company of rebels. And the uninformed person going by would have thought that that's exactly what Jesus was. Why all of these facts? These are just facts. What is so spiritual about these facts? Well, I think that part of what Mark is doing here is he is reminding his readers that the events that unfolded, not only in AD 33, but specifically on Good Friday and on Easter Sunday, that these happened in history. These really happened. There was a place. You could get a map out and you could say, that's where it happened. There was a time. You could get a watch and say, this is when it began and this is when it ended in the course of the day. There was a date. Scholars have figured out, partly with the help of astronomical information, that Jesus was crucified on Friday, April 3rd, AD 33. There was a date. Just as the creed says, he suffered under Pontius Pilate, a Roman governor who ruled from AD 26 to 36. He was crucified, dead, and buried. This happened in history. Does that matter to you? When I became a Christian, I began to discover Christian music. I was, I think, about 17. The first bit of music that I began to rediscover was the church hymn book, and I enjoyed singing hymns. And then I began to experience this newfangled thing called contemporary Christian music. And one of the songs was written by a Ralph Carmichael. Some of you will remember his name. I think the name of the tune was "He's Everything to Me." And there was a line in it that I still remember. It goes, "I will celebrate nativity, for it has a place in history." Not only does it rhyme, but it's true. And that was kind of a new thought to me, that the things that I was reading about in the Bible, and especially in the gospel, that these were historical events. A number of years ago, my wife and I were in Prince Edward Island in the city of Charlottetown. It's called the Cradle of Confederation. And we were in some of the buildings where the big meetings took place, where John A. MacDonald and the crew put it all together, framed what today we call Canada. And it just made it come alive. Being in these old buildings and seeing pictures and reading some of the plaques on the wall, it made it come alive. And it makes me wonder, do we as Christians living in the 21st century, do we value the physicality of Jesus' passion? Do we realize that in the Bible we're only getting two dimensions, that there was sound, that there was sight, that there was smell, that all of the senses would have been involved, there was a physicality to this event? What helps us to keep it real, to make it real? What helps you? Well, one of the things that helps me is having regular communion. Just every week, taking the bread and feeling it, having a cup and drinking it. The senses are involved in this, aren't they? Sometimes it's even a little bit humorous. A couple of weeks ago, I was trying to get one of the cups out, and it wasn't moving. So I had to go to it was stuck, so then I went to the next one. It wasn't moving either. I was having issues right there, but it's just part of the experience, part of the physicality of it. I'm sure there may have been some humor even at the Last Supper that wasn't recorded in the Bible. Another thing I think that helps us is reading a book or watching a film about the life of Jesus and the death of Christ, and there are all sorts of them out there. Some of you have been fortunate enough to visit the Holy Land. And invariably, when people come back from modern-day Palestine or the Holy Land, they will tell me, you know what? The Bible comes alive like it never has before. I haven't gone. Perhaps someday I will. A number of years ago, when we were vacationing in Florida and we had attended some of the theme parks, we heard about one called Holy Land Experience. Marby and I were talking about that a while ago. And I didn't know if I wanted to go at first. I thought, you know, Orlando, Holy Land Experience. Is this going to be kooky? Is this going to be well done? For some reason, we ended up going, and we had a wonderful time. They just had some world-class exhibits and different activities for people to participate in. And again, it helped us to keep the facts of the crucifixion segment of the Bible alive. What works for you? What helps you? Invariably, there are tools and resources like that that you can use. Mark gives us these facts. These are the facts of history. Well, the third scene, we've looked at helping Jesus and crucifying Jesus. Now mocking Jesus, verses 29 to 32. This is interesting. Mark slows the story down. If he's been going too fast for you, you'll probably find this next paragraph helpful. He slows it down and he puts his readers at the foot of the cross. And he says, now listen, tell me what you hear. Watch. Tell me what you see. There are three groups who are ganging up, as it were, on the Son of Man. There are passers-by, there are religious leaders, and thirdly, there were the victims who were being crucified with him, one on the left, one on the right. They were being verbally abusive. They were hurling insults at him. I don't know if I've ever had anybody hurl an insult at me. What would that be like? They hurled insults. It sounds nasty, doesn't it? Not friendly at all. It also says that they were gesturing. They were shaking their heads. Have you ever been with somebody who kind of shook their head disapprovingly about you, something you've said or something you've worked, something that you have done, rather? And then thirdly, it says that they were disavowing him. They were saying, you know what? You said, but look what you did. And they noticed that there was a gap between some of the claims that Jesus had made. Jesus, of course, had said that he was Messiah. He said that he was God's agent. He said that he was the judge. He was the one who would judge the world. And as they looked up on the cross, they saw a man who was weak, a man who was just the shadow of his former self, a man who was impotent and powerless. And they said, we don't think so. We don't think you are who you said you were. Jesus' suffering was essential to his mission. If he had taken their advice, if he had come down off the cross, what would have happened to his mission? His mission would have failed. The success of his mission depended upon his staying on the cross. If he had come down, how could he? If he had decided, you know what? Good point. I should save myself. If he had decided that he would do that, and I assume he could have, if he had come down and he had chosen to save himself, how would he have been able to save you or me or my kids or our congregants? Wouldn't have been able to do it. His mission would have failed. And so the success of his mission depended upon him, in a sense, doing nothing. Doing nothing. And he stayed right where he was. Have you ever tried to imitate Jesus' approach to suffering? You know, turn the other cheek and all that. It's not easy. Anybody ever ridiculed you for being a Christ follower? Or for believing that sexual intimacy was intended by God for a marriage between a man and a woman? Just two of you? And thought, wow, you really are old-fashioned. I can't believe that you believe that. Sometimes when we feel pushed and prodded and ridiculed and criticized, well, it's not easy. It's not easy to act like Jesus. Many of us have read books or seen movies of the civil rights movements in the 50s and the 60s. These were amazing people. I think that some of them were genuinely motivated by biblical principle. I have heard stories of black people who would go into a restaurant where there were two seating sections. There was one for blacks and there was one for whites. And to show their passive resistance, as it were, they would go and sit in the white section. And they would be booed and jeered, and they would be arrested and sometimes beaten up, thrown in jail overnight, and the next day they would go back to the same restaurant and do it all over again, because they believed that the laws were wrong and they believed that they were on the side of right. And while they were not willing to take up arms, they were willing to show passive resistance, which seems similar to what Jesus did here. Peter puts it like this: when they hurled their insults at him, he did not retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. Instead, he entrusted himself to him who judges justly. Are you good at doing that? That's hard. And you know what? In the years ahead, we may have ample opportunity to exercise this more than now. A number of years ago, there was a movie that came out called 42, and it was about the first black man to play in the Major League Baseball. The baseball player's name was Jackie Robinson, and the man who hired him, signed his contract, was the owner, Branch Rickey. And just from some reading that I've done, I'm wondering if Branch Rickey wasn't in fact a Christian. But when he hired this baseball player, Jackie Robinson, he said, "Look, you're the first black guy. This is not going to be easy. They are going to give you a hard time. And when you get out there," he told him that he didn't want him to fight back. And Robinson at the time said, "You mean you want a player who doesn't have the guts to fight back?" And Rickey said, "No, I want a player who's got the guts not to fight back." Passive resistance. This is similar, I think, to what Jesus practiced in the closing hours of his life. You ever tried that? Have you ever thought of following Christ quite like that? That's challenging. Well, we've looked at the first part, the crucifixion segment. Now let's look at what I'm going to call the death sequence, verses 33 to 41. Jesus' death is now portrayed in a series of what I would call incidents. They're almost too short to be episodes. They're too short to be called scenes. They're just little snippets. Mark, like super duper, abbreviates them, and he just gives them to him. Toot, 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 six of them. Let's go through them. First, he describes the unnatural darkness of the time. An unnatural darkness falls over the land. Now, in the Bible, when it gets dark during the day, and I mean really dark during the day, that is not a good thing. That usually means that the deity is angry. When it gets dark in the middle of the day, that is usually a good time to run for cover. When I was a seminary student living in Dallas, we lived in a part of the States called Tornado Alley. And you can imagine what came rumbling through Tornado Alley. One day, middle of the afternoon, it was about 3 o'clock, it got so weirdly dark. Like, it was just eerie. And it got so dark that the street light started to come on. And I just thought to myself, this can't be good. I didn't know at the time that my wife, who had been listening to the radio, was underneath a table in our home along with our one-year-old son, because it was possible that something rather untoward might happen. So there was this unnatural darkness It just was foreboding. It just had the aura of judgment. Verses 34 to 36, we hear Jesus' sad lament. One scholar has written, 6 hours after he was placed on the cross and after 3 hours of darkness, Jesus felt abandoned by God. Now, not only significant that he felt abandoned by God, but that he said so. Jesus, like so many writers in the Old Testament, when they felt that God wasn't doing what they had wanted him to do, when they felt abandoned by God, when they felt that God was inactive, when they felt that perhaps they weren't being delivered as they should be, they would cry out in lament. And Jesus lamented the absence of God, the inactivity of God in his life. He felt abandoned by God. Made me wonder, do we ever voice our complaints? I mean, to God. I know we voice our complaints. I actually hear a lot of your complaints from time to time. But, you know, do we ever voice our complaints to God? Godly men did in Old Testament times. Godly women. And Jesus did. And I think we should too. Verse 37, the last breath of Christ. This marks the end of Jesus' earthly life. We all know how this works. At the beginning of life, the infant fills its lungs for the very first time. And at the end of life, a person will breathe their last breath. Have you ever seen somebody die? I haven't seen many people die. I have seen a few. And I can remember one woman. We were in a nursing home. Her family was gathered around them. I had been invited to be there with them. And her breathing was laborious. I mean, she was filling up her lungs, and then she was exhaling. She was inhaling, and she was exhaling. And finally, it came to the moment where she inhaled for the last time and exhaled, and that was it. And I don't know if it was just me, but it was a moving moment. There was this emotional rush. I imagine that there we were at the end of the continuum of this woman's life, and we were watching God, witnessing God do something every bit as miraculous as what had happened the day that she was born, when life was given, and now life was being taken back to her. That's what Jesus experienced that day, his last breath. I noticed in the obituary column here recently in The Advocate, the death of E. Frank Murphy. I don't know if any of you knew E. Frank Murphy. He passed away March the 9th. Frank Murphy was Connie Tomalty's boss. He was a lawyer. And he was our lawyer who helped us, the first home that we bought and sold. March the 9th was the day that E. Frank Murphy breathed his last breath. All of us here today have had day one. We were born, and all of us, one day, will have the kind of experience that E. Frank Murphy had, that Jesus had, and every other person who has ever died will have. We will breathe our last breath. And the neat thing about passages like this is it helps us to get ready for that moment. I'm not really looking forward to it. I'm not really wanting to get there any sooner than I absolutely have to, but when I'm there, I want to be ready for it. I want to be prepared to transition from this life to the next life. We'll talk about that more in just a moment. There is the curtain tearing, verse 38. We've all heard this story. The curtain, it says, was torn from top to bottom. That is the biblical writer's way of saying man didn't do it. This was a God thing. God was signaling a change when he tore the temple curtain from top to bottom. He was signaling a change in how we approach God. He was saying, and this took people in the early church a while to comprehend, he was saying there will no longer be a need for the temple. There will no longer be a need for animal sacrifice. There will no longer be a need for temple ritual. Things have all changed because of the death of my son. We all know what barriers do. They keep us out. A number of months ago, I was trying to go to one of my favorite walking places, River Bend Golf Course. Have a beautiful perimeter around the outskirts of it. When I got to the road that I normally travel down, there was a barrier there. And it kind of annoyed me. Because now to get there, you know, there was this long, all the way around Jack Robinson's barn, and I kind of liked a more direct route. Well, a few months later, guess what? The barriers came down. And it was like someone was saying, okay, we now give you direct access again. That's what God was saying to the human family when he tore the temple curtain. There is now direct access to me through my son and his sacrifice. Enjoy. Do we take advantage of this as couples? Do we take advantage of this access as a congregation? I think we do. As individuals, I think we do. I think we get it. But we should probably do it more. God is inviting us in. Come on in. Woo. I don't know. I mean, really, in the Old Testament, who got to go in there? It was believed that the presence of God was in the inner sanctum of the temple. And the only person who could go there was one, the high priest, and even that person could only go one day of the year, on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. And now God throws it wide open and he says, y'all come in now, through Christ and faith in him. You're welcome. Come on in. What are we doing with the welcome of God? There was an unexpected confession in verse 39. A surprising statement from an unexpected source. We have not heard since chapter 1, verse 1 of Mark's gospel, someone confess that Jesus is the Son of God. It's like bookends. Mark 1, Mark 15. The first confession came from Mark. You would expect him to say that, a devout Christian man. This is coming from a Roman centurion who had witnessed these events. And he said, surely this man must be the Son of God, was the Son of God. Amazing sometimes how the religious folk miss what other people get. He got it. The religious folk didn't. Finally, there were witnesses, 40 and 41. Who was it that witnessed the final minutes of Jesus' life? Was it the disciples? Oh no. Oh no, they're long gone. They were seriously into self-preservation, the very thing that Jesus was not into. Oh, they were long gone. But there were some women there, some devout women, women who actually had been with Jesus for a long time, serving him, ministering to him, being loyal to him. I wonder, where are the men? But you know what? There almost seems to be a bit of a parallel in church history here. So often, when I have met missionaries, I know when I was a young kid, I would always meet women missionaries, female missionaries. And I don't know if I actually wondered, but I should have wondered, so where are the men? And many of the churches that I've pastored, it seems like there's almost an inordinate number of devout women, sometimes women who come to church alone without their husband because their husband isn't into stuff like this. And it's remarkable. Has it always been this way? It seems like it was that way to some extent in the first century. And to some extent, I think it's still that way today. If you're looking, often it seems if you're looking for someone who is a real faithfulness leader, look for a woman. I'm so thankful for the faithfulness expressed by women here at Balmoral and for the faithfulness expressed by men as well. If you want a good example of praying, often look to a woman, looking for a good example of who cares for others. Who does it better than women? Do guys need caring for? You know, I mean, is that a manly thing to care for another man? Well, I don't know. We're a little slow off the mark sometimes, but women get it. And in a congregation this size, there are so many needs, irrespective of gender, and we need to be cared for. And if you're a man, you probably should be cared for by another man other than your spouse. And if you're a woman, you should be cared for by another woman. But we need to be cared for. Ah, these women, they stepped up. Let's follow their example. What does it mean? Well, earlier we asked the question, how did the disciples know that Jesus was nearing the completion of his mission? When he began to suffer. That was a signal that the accomplishment of his mission was at hand. And he has suffered and died, we have just seen. That was the sign that the deliverance that God had promised, it was getting worked out. When they heard Jesus lament and say, my God, why have you forsaken me? That was the sound of reconciliation being hammered out in the life and the lifeblood of Jesus Christ. Well, it's good to know that there's a salvation. How do we share in it? I mean, that's really what we want to know. It's great that there is a salvation. How do we have a share in it?
And I think there's a number of things indicated in Mark's gospel. One of them is that we must always remember that Jesus' suffering was saving suffering. There are all kinds of different ways to suffer. I have suffered a tiny little bit in my life, and I don't think any of it was saving suffering. A lot of it was just a big nuisance. Jesus' suffering was saving. His death was more than just poignant. Sometimes we see, Diana and I recently saw an animal that got struck by a car, and it was clearly suffering. And it was just sort of one of those, why does this have to happen, you know? But that was it. Nobody was getting saved by the suffering of this animal. It was poignant, but that was about it. Sometimes suffering is admirable. It's like, be a man, you know, grit your teeth, take it like a man. Here, bite on this pencil. Do whatever you need to do. Don't cry out. Sometimes it's admirable the way that people bear up under suffering. But Jesus' suffering wasn't so much poignant or admirable, although there were admirable qualities to it. At the end of the day, it was saving. And that's what Easter is about. It's about God's way of rescuing the human family from the penalty of sin. And the way he did it was through the suffering of his royal son. That's the first thing I think we need to be clear about, is that Jesus' suffering was saving. Another thing is that his suffering was a kind of exchange. And we talked about that a little bit during communion. That sweet exchange of how God sends a Savior into the world to do for us what we can't do for ourselves. What a good deal. You can't save yourself. You need to be saved, but you can't be. Good news. Jesus can do it for you. He has died in your place for your benefit. That's the good news. There's that sweet exchange. But at the end of the day, we still need to activate it. Yeah, it's saving. Yeah, it's an exchange. But how do we activate it? The Bible talks about the value of personal trust. Sometimes you get a credit card. This is your credit card. And your name is on the credit card. And it's good for, you know, $5,000, $15,000, whatever your credit limit is. But you got to activate it. And there are some steps that you need to take to sort of make it your own. Well, in the Bible, we are told that the way that we activate our inclusion and participation in the salvation that Jesus has accomplished through his crucifixion and death is simply by recognizing that the approval that we so desperately need, the forgiveness that we so desperately need but don't deserve, that it is ours for the asking, that God is willing to give it to those who are small enough, as it were, to receive it. To those who are willing to abandon a philosophy of achievement. I'm going to get this. I'm a self-made man. I can do this for myself. No. It doesn't work that way when it comes to gaining God's approval. It's recognizing that it's already been gained, been achieved, just needs to be received. I did that when I was 17. Some of you were smarter than me. You did it sooner in life. Some of you did it later in life. Perhaps you're here today and you've never done it. But you know, you could do it today. You could kind of do a 180. You could say, you know what? I'm one of those people who, I always thought that if you want it, you got to go out and get it for yourself. And if what you're saying today about the gospel, this good news, this message of Christ dying on the cross, if you're right in what you're saying, I realize I don't have to earn it. It doesn't mean that God won't ask anything of me after he gives me this amazing gift. But at the end of the day, it's his achievement and not mine. And I like that. And I need it. And I want it. And I'm going to ask God for it. Because you know what? That's the thing. I can't ask God to give it to you. I mean, I can, but he actually wants you to approach him for yourself. And I can't do it for you, and you can't do it for me. There are some things you kind of got to do yourself. And in just a moment, I want to give you an opportunity to do that. I want to send you home today with a question. And the question quite simply is, in what are you trusting for God's approval? You can think of your life as a ladder. And you get to put that ladder on some wall. You can put it on the wall of self-salvation. You can put it on the wall of personal achievement. Or you can put it on the wall of what Christ has done for us through his dying and rising on our behalf. But be careful. Be careful where you rest the ladder of your life, because if you put it on the wrong wall, you will regret it forever. So let's pray. Father, we thank you today for Jesus.
We still shake our heads as we try to get our minds around why he did all that he did for us. Wow. But we understand that he requires from us a heartfelt, intelligent, and personal response. And if we have never done this yet in our lives, we want to do it right now. We want to recognize that Jesus' death was saving and sacrificial. And we want to recognize that it was an exchange. It was something that he did for us so that we wouldn't have to experience abandonment from you. And it's a step that we want to take for ourselves right now, whether to reaffirm a step that we had previously taken or perhaps to take it for the very first time. We want to put our weight down on Christ and what he has done. And we want to stop trusting in anything that we might do to achieve your approval. We pray this honestly and sincerely today in Jesus' name. Amen. And as always, if you'd like to talk to me about anything that we have talked about today, I'd be happy to do that.